Alors j'attends que tout le monde prenne ou reprenne sa place et je vais donner ensuite la parole à Madame Judith Turchuk qui enseigne à l'Université Lille 3 et dont tous les spécialistes connaissent les compétences de philologue et de sanskritiste pour une communication qui, je l'espère, n'excédera pas 30 minutes parce que nous avons déjà pris un peu de retard et je tremble devant les organisateurs. Voilà. Bien, je vous donne la parole, s'il vous plaît.
Merci bien. First, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this conference, which I think also shows that philology is not at all dead in France. And I wouldn't have said that, say, 15 years ago, but I think that a lot of things have changed, and in the past, say, 10 years, we can perhaps talk about that later. But, so I think philology is very much alive here. Textual studies, let's say. The remarks that make up this paper originate in some reflections made while editing Abhinavagupta's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. With Professor Lynn Bansaboudon, we are preparing a critical edition and translation of the text. The mula commented on is the Kashmirian recension of the Gita, which will also be included in the edition in the form it was probably read by Abhinavagupta. Now, this Kashmirian recension often differs from the well-known recension of the Gita, also called the Vulgate. Before delving into the subject, let me say a few words about this Kashmirian Gita and Abhinava's commentary thereon in general. The commentary is a short one entitled Sangraha, a summary, probably one of the first works of the young Abhinavagupta, but it already reflects his non-dualist Shaiva leaning. According to his introduction, this commentary is faithful to the tradition handed down by Bhattinduraja, one of Abhinavagupta's acharyas, but is enriched with Abhinavagupta's own ideas, Vivichyachachiram Dhiya. The author explains right at the beginning that he intends to acknowledge both action, karman, and knowledge, jnana, as important factors, but he also wants to lay emphasis on jnana as the dominant element, for if action is guided by right knowledge, it will not be binding. Therefore, they are not at the same level. Now, as to the Kashmirian recension, Otto Schrader published a partial edition of this recension in 1930, using a Birchbark manuscript and selected evidence from Kashmirian commentaries. In spite of its shortcomings, it is a remarkable edition, I think, which has also sparked much interest and controversy. It is not the place to enter into debate on this subject, for in any case, it is certain that Abhinavagupta had the Kashmirian recension in front of him, no matter what the relationship of this recension to the others is. Nevertheless, it is of some interest that the Kashmirian recension appears to have variants that often seem to be closer to the style of the epic in general, although these variants are not sufficient on their own to establish the priority of the Kashmirian recension. And let me show you a manuscript with this Kashmirian recension and the commentary on the margins. Actually, there are two commentaries on the margins. Coming back to Abhinavagupta, in addition to the main question of karma and jnana, he also tries to accomplish two, secondary exegetical tasks without saying it explicitly. So this is actually my own understanding of what he does. He intends to present an epic text, a Purana, as a philosophical treatise, Shastra. And he comments on a Vaishnava text as if it propounded the teaching of non-dualist Shaivism. The main issue I'd like to look into is how Abhinavagupta, as an exegetical philologist, deals with the Bhagavad Gita as an epic text as part of the Mahabharata. How does he explain certain epic textual features, such as the question of the author or speaker, particularities of epic grammar, possible glitches in the argument, or repetitions? Incidentally, given that Abhinavagupta provides a Shaiva commentary, it is also inevitable to speak of his exegetical strategy and how he appropriates or colonizes an a priori alien territory. Of course, it's not completely alien because it's still within the Hindu fold, but nevertheless, a Vaishnava. I should also say that there will be nothing fancy, extraordinary in the sense, in my presentation here, in the sense that other classical authors use more or less the same sort of devices and arguments. So Abhinavagupta's procedure is not unique on the whole, even if he does have some ingenious solutions at times here and there. But this text, this commentary seems to me a good example to show how a classical author proceeds with his source. So first, let's see the questions of author and speaker. Who speaks here? Sage Vyasa, evidently. Abhinavagupta tells us from the very beginning that the Bhagavad Gita must be understood as part of Vyasa's epic text, and even more than that, some kind of culmination of the epic. For according to his interpretation, the entire epic is there to explain how to obtain final liberation, moksha, the other aims of man being subjected to that supreme one. And it is this subject matter, the obtainment of moksha, which is supposed to run through the whole epic in various forms, to become then the main topic of the Bhagavad Gita. So he says, this is the first citation, in this treatise, Shastra, of 100,000 shlokas, that is the Mahabharata, composed by the sage Vyasa, it is taught that the main aim is liberation, and that the other aims of man, such as dharma, are there to contribute to it. Even if final liberation is propounded in association with other subjects elsewhere in the epic, it is the Bhagavad Gita that provides an adequate exposition of how to obtain it. So here in the introductory verses, the whole epic is basically declared to be a learned treatise, a shastra, whose aim, as in the case of any shastra, is to explain how to leave behind the world of transmigration. In the subsequent prose part of the introduction, Abhinavagupta also points out that he shall explain Vyasa's intention, his abhipraya, in various parts of the commentary. And may I refer to Professor Deshpande's paper yesterday, which also mentioned this quest for the abhipraya. Thus, Abhinavagupta presents the Gita as an extract of a learned treatise, the Mahabharata, whose author is Vyasa the scholar. That you can see here, well, from elsewhere, but at least from around the same period. Now, being faithful to this idea, he quotes other passages of the Mahabharata to clarify some arguments or to support his claim that it is Vyasa's intention he wants to show us. For instance, at 1723, he cites a passage taken from the Adiparvan to show that according to Vyasa, sacrifice becomes binding only or tainting only if it is performed with a particular aim in mind. And at 219, he cites the Shantiparvan to demonstrate that Vyasa himself insists on the impermanent nature of things, interesting thing, even if the changes things undergo may hardly be perceptible. Let us remark here that Abhinavagupta also introduces Shastric terminology here, Arthakriya Karitva, which may not be intended by the epic. We can of course all agree that the Muni, or for us Vyasa is the compiler, is the ultimate author. However, in most of the dialogue that makes up the Bhagavad Gita, it is Krishna who speaks. For this reason, it is divine revelation, and it clearly appears as such in Abhinavagupta's commentary. Except that the identity of the God is far from being evident, and Abhinavagupta never raises the question of identity explicitly. One must, in fact, go through his scattered remarks in order to reconstruct who actually propounds the teaching of the Gita according to him. So who is this Lord that speaks? Now, in some passages, Abhinavagupta seems to speak of the Gita as Lord as if he were simply Shiva. He glosses the first person singulars referring to the God with Parameshvara and in particular Maheshvara, even if Parameshvara could of course refer to Vishnu as well, Maheshvara denotes rather Shiva. And if this were not enough, there are some other clues for us to see that Shiva is meant here. Abhinavagupta glosses Parameshvara with he who is made of consciousness, Chidatman, and he calls him the free or autonomous one, Svatantra. Epithets that on their own may not be significant, but taken together, they form a hallmark of Abhinavagupta's non-dualist Shaivism. So, of course, it would be foolish to suggest that Svatantra, for instance, is a hallmark, but Parameshvara Svatantra is actually a collocation that Abhinavagupta uses in particular. Now, at 1312, he goes as far as to affirm that there is nothing else but Maheshvara, the Supreme Self, Paramatma, no Maheshvara anyad aparam nakinchid asti. At the same time, in many passages, the Supreme God of the Gita retains his original identity as Krishna, Vasudeva. Abhinavagupta calls him Vasudeva several times, speaking of him as the Lord who is identical with the universe, Vasudeva eva sarvam, and mentioning that one is promised to obtain an awareness of Vasudeva's reality, Vasudeva tattva. Just a visual representation of the double identity of this god at this period. Now, occasionally, this Vasudeva reality is said to be attained with very unusual means. For the grace or power of the Lord, of Lord Shiva, Shakti itself or herself, descends to facilitate its attainment. So this is a rather extraordinary passage that starts with by knowing that Vasudeva is everything. It will turn into completely Shaiva text. One's heart is favored by the descent of the supreme Shakti, Parashakti, which comes about right after the equalization of karmas, which are produced by enjoyments throughout many births. Then one attains the reality of the Lord. Such passages suggest that in some way Vasudeva and Shiva become identified here. This is indeed confirmed in the very end of Abhinavagupta's commentary, where he finally declares that the Lord, whoever he is, Bhagavan, unites the Supreme Self with Ishvara, in other words, Shiva, and Vasudeva. Paramatmanam Ishvaram Vasudevam cha ekataya ujjayati. In a similar vein, but going somewhat further, Abhinavagupta introduces another verse by saying that for someone who knows what was previously said, even the worship of Indra and of the other gods is in fact the worship of Parameshvara. Thus, whichever other ritual act one performs, it takes on the form of the worship of Maheshvara as oneself. The last citation suggests that although these gods are identified, Maheshvara is somehow above the others. This also appears to be implied by Abhinavagupta when he mentions the attainment of Shiva as following up on Vasudevahood. Te Vasudevatam prapya labhante eva paramam Shivam. Now, turning back to Vyasa, as we have seen, Abhinavagupta insists on his own faithfulness to Vyasa's text and that he wants to interpret the Gita in accordance with Vyasa's intention. At a place where he proposes a particularly unusual understanding of the word daiva, he also says, I shall explain what Vyasa had in his heart, yo artho hridi sthitas, which conforms to the principle of consistency, paurvaparya virudhatvat, or which is so because it conforms to the principle of consistency. Here he evokes not only his faithfulness to authorial intentions, but also the principle of consistency, purvaparya virutattva, an important philological one, no matter how fragile it is. This may join what Vincent Elschinger said about the question of internal contradictions that need to be explained eventually. Similarly, elsewhere, Abhinavagupta mentions that Vyasa cannot contradict his own ideas. More specifically, he says, here Vyasa does not emphasize yogic suicide, utkranti, as that would contradict the mention of the non-dual character of the Supreme Spirit. In other words, if one is identical with the Godhead, there is no need to commit yogic suicide for liberation. One can be liberated in this very life, recognizing one's identity with this Godhead. And we can already see that he's already against utkranti, against yogic suicide, as it becomes very prominent in his discourse later as well. Now, the idea of Vyasa's consistency pops up elsewhere too, in some passages that contain series of questions. There are a few places in the Gita where Arjuna asks a series of questions in the manner of someone who requests a more detailed explanation. Now, these places, Abhinavagupta takes up each and every question, makes a numbered list of them, and attempts to find the answer to each in Krishna's reply. He does so, for instance, in his commentary on 254 and on the following, on the next verses, and also on 8:1-2. Here again, he takes pains to show the Shastric rigor and the consistency of Vyasa's text. In addition to consistency, Abhinavagupta also presupposes a certain density of meaning or textual richness in his source, just as other exegetes do, by the way. So again, this is not particularly Abhinavagupta, but let's see his example. One good example for this can be found in his commentary on the famous line, Ashochyan Anushochanstvam. And by the way, this line differs in the Kashmirian recension, so those who know the Gita by heart in the Vulgate recension shouldn't be surprised that this is slightly different. So this is commonly translated, and reasonably so, you have lamented on those who shouldn't be lamented upon. And Abhinavagupta here proposes that the suffix of the verbal noun or gerundive, kritya pratyaya, should be understood in two ways, in the sense of ability, shakti, and in the sense of merit, arhi. In other words, those who cannot be lamented upon and those who do not deserve to be lamented upon. Thus, he ends up with a double meaning here. You lament on the death of souls that cannot be lamented upon and on the death of bodies which do not merit lamentations. The principle of textual richness is also applied in cases of repetition of ideas. In other words, Abhinavagupta cannot assume any actual repetition in Vyasa's text in conformity with Shastric style, for repetition would mean redundancy, a waste of words, a stylistic defect. In such cases, different meanings are attributed to the repeated words or to the synonyms. One such instance is in verse 2:19, in which bodies are described as antavantaha, having an end, and vinashina, perishable, boiling down to the same thing, basically a clear case of repeating the same idea. And again, the Vulgate reads differently here. We can go back to that if you like later. In order to avoid the repetition, which probably did not disturb the authors as much as it did Abhinavagupta, he points out that the first word refers to the gross destruction of bodies. So antavanta would refer to stula vinasha, the destruction that you see if, say, I drop dead suddenly and then my body will be destroyed. But there is also a second one, and the second one would denote the subtle destruction. So vinashina would denote sukshma vinasha, which is the destruction that I'm undergoing now while I'm speaking. Finally, let us turn to grammatical irregularities in the Gita and what Abhinavagupta does with them. There are relatively few irregularities of language in the Gita when compared to other mainly narrative parts of the epic. No confusion of the masculine and neuter here, or cases of verbal or nominal thematizations. A few irregularities can nevertheless be identified, and Abhinavagupta also mentions some of them. Here too, he seems to hesitate whether he should evoke the authority of sage Vyasa or that of the Lord. For at one place, commenting on Aswara Bhakti, he states that the form is acceptable because the sage Vyasa is a valid means of knowledge, munih pramanatvad. He also remarks that other irregularities should be seen in the same way. At another place, he justifies an irregular active for the middle, not by Vyasa's authority, but by saying that this is simply a scriptural chandasa irregularity. Indeed, in this verse, it is more natural to understand that the text is a revelation, for the speaker Krishna uses the first person singular to refer to himself in the same verse. One can, however, also find examples in which, instead of evoking authorities, Abhinavagupta twists the sentence structure to avoid an irregularity. 136 CD reads in the Gita, Papam ivashtaid asman hatvaitan atatainah, which can naturally be interpreted, if we kill these murderers, sin shall befall upon us. This understanding, however, implies that the subject of the gerund, hatva, is the object of the sentence, us, man, us, which would go against proper Sanskrit grammar. We need the subject of hatva to be either in the nominative or in the instrumental. Abhinav Navagupta finds an ingenious solution. He takes papam to be the subject of hatva, atatainam hanani papam iva kartri. Thus, he avoids the problematic syntax and understands sin, having killed these murderers, shall befall upon us. And finally, some more general remarks about texts and their consistency. Abhinavagupta is certainly not the only exegete who treats his texts with some freedom and tries to upgrade it stylistically as well as content-wise. Nor is the epic or the Gita within it the only or the most typical example for a text that exegetes attempt to upgrade. Although if someone were to write the textual history of the Gita, numerous additional epic irregularities could be identified, which would show that the text has undergone quite a lot of indigenous editing. So that actually I think that the text of the Gita is less regular than we think. But that's again in between brackets now. So in conclusion, many questions could be raised concerning the way in which textual studies were practiced by classical Indian authors such as Abhinav Gupta. And rather than raising such questions, I would like to single out a particular problem, the premise of consistency. Abhinav Gupta, as well as other exegetes, assume that the text they write about is perfectly consistent in its content, language, and style, and they often use this assumption in their own particular way. Of course, one could label them as tendentious and the like, but the premise of consistency is actually one that every philologist uses in one way or another. And it may be an important methodological question to know how much consistency one can assume a text to have. Now, Abhinav Navagupta was certainly not concerned by such questions, for his aim was not to uncover a historical reality, but to access a spiritual reality, which was considered to be perfect, and therefore perfectly consistent. Now, we know that the historical reality we are after is certainly not fully consistent. It has rough edges, contradictions we cannot explain. Therefore, our premise of consistency is much more fragile and more difficult to justify. This is not to say that we should throw it out because it doesn't conform to hard scientific principles, but it may sometimes need some more fine-tuning. I'm afraid I cannot propose any hard and fast method for such fine-tuning. Statistical methods may help to some extent, but it seems difficult and methodologically questionable, as well as paradoxical, to measure consistency or inconsistency in a fully consistent way. For this reason, I think we must simply accept that we ourselves cannot be fully consistent in the way in which we apply any standard of consistency. This, just as most methodological questions in philology, doesn't mean that we should stop our efforts, because we cannot reach some kind of objective perfectionism in this matter. But just as it is a good piece of advice for philologists to be, quote, resolutely objective but passionately non-neutral, unquote, so too with regard to the question of consistency, it may be important to be rigorously consistent while regularly defying the principle of consistency. And I hope our edition of the Gita Arthasangraha will consistently do so. Thank you.